Okay. We are talking about the wisdom that James has to share with us from the standpoint of the blessings that come from doing. We were discussing what he has to say in the section beginning in verse 22, where he talks about not merely listening to the word but doing what it says. We discussed, had a kind of a side discussion on the law of liberty, and as he uses and refers to the law of liberty, the royal law, and what all that means. So now we're back to some more discussion on blessed by doing, and we're looking at three specific examples that James gives to us, basically from the idea of saying, you know, we talk about, you know, we need to do what God tells us to do, not just listen to his word, but to do it. And James then gives these three specific examples of how to apply that idea of knowing and doing. We talked about the first one last week, where he talks about us and being careful about how we use our tongue and how that connects to our religion and so forth. And he says, if anyone considers himself religious yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. And so last week we were discussing worthless religion and and how so often there are things that we look at that people are doing, and we look at ourselves and we go, well, I don't kill people, I don't rob people, I'm a good person, and so forth, and yet we don't consider what God's Word says about things like slander and gossip, and that those things are things that will render our religion worthless, because they are sins of the tongue. And so we were looking at again, some of the things that Paul talks about concerning sins, and we saw, you know, where he talks about and gives us lists of various sins and so forth, but then talking about the wicked who will not inherit the kingdom of God, and we think about those big sins, and he lists like adultery and fornication and homosexuality and greed and all those things, and right along with those he lists slander and gossip and so forth. And so again, if we can keep ourselves from doing all of those big things and feel good about ourselves, but when we don't keep a proper rein on our tongue, then we are rendering, he says, our religion worthless. Right? So that's the negative side, so to speak, a warning concerning that. But then he turns to a positive light, so to speak, and talking about taking care of people who are in need. And he talks about two different people, two groups of people, the orphans and the widows. And I think we started talking about some of this last week, but I don't think we got all the way through it, is what my note, you know, that I have here. That orphans and widows were two of the most helpless groups of people in society back then. Basically, the way that the society cultures were back then, they were a male-dominated society that basically said if you did not have a male in your family, in your household to take care of you, then your chances of survival were minimized. So, you know, that's why we look at some of the things that the Bible talks about divorce. Okay? A woman who is divorced by her husband, you know, the whole issues that Jesus talked about, I know this isn't widows, but it's the principle here is the idea that if a man divorces his wife, he just says, I put you away, well, she's divorced from him. Without a divorce decree, as Jesus talks about, you know, Moses commanded you to divorce your wife, you know, you give a decree, because what they were doing was they were basically saying, well, when I divorce you, get out of my house. She didn't have any way to prove that she was divorced, if she went and remarried somebody else, then her husband comes back and says, huh, she's an adulteress, a stoner. Okay? But if she didn't marry someone else and her father wouldn't take her back into his home, she couldn't take care of herself. Okay? Well, the same thing with orphans and widows. A woman's husband dies, if she doesn't have a son who is able to take care of her, then again, her chances of survival are very slim. Okay? Of course, orphans, you've got children who can't take care of themselves. You know, what's going to happen to them? So you have a class of people here who are the helpless that God cares tremendously about. All right? So if you go over to Psalm 68, verse 5, it calls God there the father of the fatherless and protector of the widows. So how important are orphans and widows to God? Okay? Isaiah, in Isaiah 1, 16 and 17, again talking about the God, says he brings justice to the fatherless and pleads the widow's cause. Right? So God is very concerned about widows and orphans. And James here takes from God his care and concern and says, look, here's what pure and undefiled religion looks like. Take care of the widows and the orphans in their distress. Okay? So on the one hand, if you're a religious person and you don't do all these bad things, but you don't take care of your tongue and make sure you don't, use your tongue in bad ways, you render your religion worthless. Okay? The other side of that is, he says, this is what pure and undefiled religion looks like. You take care of those who can't take care of themselves. All right? Now, interesting word that is used here when he uses the phrase look after, okay? The word that is used there is episkopotomai, and that is the same word that is used concerning shepherds or overseers or elders or bishops. All right? Same word. And so, basically, what it means here, what he's saying here, is you need to exercise oversight of the orphans and the widows. Now, who is he talking to here? Us who? Okay, he's not talking to just shepherds or overseers. He's talking to those who want to have pure and undefiled religion. Okay? So in using this word, it's not directing this responsibility to the overseers or the elders or shepherds of a church or a flock, but rather for all of us to be overseeing, okay, or caring for those who can't take care of themselves. So in other words, to look after the orphans and the widows is more than just the idea of checking in on occasion. Okay? It is the real business of the church to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves. Right? And it is pure and undefiled before God. So, in other words, we have to recognize that there is a group of people that is made up of, those who are fatherless, those who are orphans, those who are widows, who need special care. They need looking after. They need to be cared for on a regular basis. and it's so important, and those people are so important to God, that God looks upon this and says, look, you want to be religious in my sight? Take care of these people. Okay? That's pure religion. Right. Any thoughts or comments?
The New Testament addresses the plight of widows several times. But it doesn't tell us too much about the plight of orphans, so in fact, it's kind of funny that an act of talking about the Hellenistic, that's when it was turned up the deacons to take care of them, and then to give them to them, and then it starts separating them in classes, ages. Sixty and older, you know, you give them all the support you get.
Those younger ones, what's their responsibility?
Get married again.
Yeah, they have a better possibility to get taken care of because they can go and remarry. Okay? And so forth. But those who are older can't necessarily do that. And so we need to make sure they're taken care of. The second part of this, of what he describes as pure and undefiled religion, is to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Okay? If you think about it this way, talk about this word that he uses here, think about stains. What do stains do to a garment? They not only mess it up, but what do they ultimately do to it? Ruin it. They render it useless, basically. You know, I can't wear that anymore because it's got a stain. I mean, I don't know how many ties I've ruined and rendered useless, you say, because I dripped something on. Wear a tie with a big old spot on it.
Got enough time to make a good suit.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Pollution. What does that do to water? Air. And is it useless? Okay. And that's the idea here behind this word that he's using. In the Greek word, asphilos, is unspotted or unstained. It's the same word that is used concerning a lamb in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19. Somebody turn there and read that for us, please. 1 Peter 1 and 19. Okay. Alright. What kind of a lamb was Jesus? Without spot and without a blemish. Okay? Go back to the law of Moses, and what was the requirement under the law of Moses for the sacrifices, the animals that were to be used in sacrifices? Or blemish or defect. A one-year-old lamb without spot or defect. So, you know, you can't just go and pick out a lamb and go, oh, that one's got a broken leg, it's going to die anyway, I'll go ahead and use that as a sacrifice. Not acceptable to God. Right? And so here, James is telling us, you want to have pure and undefiled religion, you need to keep yourself unspotted or unstained or unblemished from the world. Why is that so important? Somebody go over to Romans chapter 12, 1 and 2 and read for us, please. What are we to do with our bodies? chapter 12, Romans 12, verses 1 and 2.
Therefore, on earth we call the nation of Israel to do with God's mercy to offer the bodies of the living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is the true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and you will be able to test and prove what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will.
Okay. In view of God's mercy, okay. In other words, keeping before you the fact that God was merciful to us and sent His Son to die to take away our sins, okay? Keeping that ever before you, God's mercy in that, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, not dead sacrifices like were offered under the Old Testament law of Moses, but living sacrifices, okay? That are holy and pleasing unto God. And he says, this is your what? Your spiritual act of worship. Right? So as you come before God to worship, what kind of body or life is you're offering? He's not just talking about our physical body, but it's our life that we're living in this physical body. Understand that. What kind of body and life should that be? Right, but also one without spot or blemish or defect, you see. That we are to offer ourselves, our bodies, as living sacrifices. Right, without spot or defect. James is saying, keep yourself unspotted from the world. Okay? Paul goes on to say, following that statement, do what? Do not conform any longer to the patterns of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Don't live like the world is living, right? You see? You've got to live differently from the world. So pure and undefiled religion, then, at least this part of it, is to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Don't let the world drag you into its cesspool. Okay. Don't live like the world is living. We have a responsibility as God's people and as a living sacrifice being offered daily to God to live in such a way that our lives are not dragged into worldliness. Okay. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 through 18. Let me get somebody to read that for us. What's one of the ways that we really need to pay attention to this and that we can keep ourselves from being unspotted from the world or unduly influenced and dragged into the world's garbage pit? Who's got that for us? What is Paul's admonition here? 2 Corinthians 6, 14 through 18. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Okay? They will drag you down. They will drag you down into the pit. That oftentimes, Brian's been continuing what you're saying, oftentimes we we look at situations, we look at ourselves and say, well, but that won't happen to me. I'm stronger than that. You know, what have you. I heard and saw, I'm sorry, Charlotte, go ahead.
This is what happened with our young people and even new converts, even some of the older. Sometimes you can't distinguish what's going on out there because they make it so enticing, right. So
innocent looking.
Yeah, this is all right. And a lot of our young people, once they are converted, they don't know how to distinguish.
Right.
They're having those friends because their friend is nice, but they're not doing nice things. And that's how they fall into that trap. And once they get into that trap, it's hard.
Right. Once you get the stains on, it's hard to get them off, isn't it? You know? Yeah. I saw an illustration one time that I think was really, perfect example of this, that people, you know, we tend, as I said, to think that, you know, well, that won't happen to me. I'm much stronger than that, and so forth. And the illustration is basically this. Daddy, can I ask you to move over here a little bit? I'm going to use Ray because he's a perfect example of this, okay? I don't want to step on your coat here, all right? Let me ask you a question. Which would be easier to accomplish? For me to pull Ray up here on this bench with me or for him to pull me down there with him? Right? Now, you know, Ray, you know, he's got some physical, you know, infirmities that, you know, his strength is not, you know, 100% and all that. Which do you think would be, I mean, you know, whole lot easier for him to pull me down than for me to pull him up, right? And you see, the point is, that's what we oftentimes as Christians think, oh, well, I'm strong, I can pull them up to my level. May be able to, but not as easily as they can pull you down to theirs.
Okay?
And that's what happens so often, is we allow ourselves to think, I can do this. We get pulled down and dragged down into the cesspool because we're not strong. But Ryan, we do the other
one. You know, the devil has a way of making the world look right. Especially with all the religion we've got going on. You hear that phrase so often. Doesn't God want you to be happy?
Right.
So often we're getting vain thinking we're not, because we're not following God's word or studying God's word to know what the difference is between the world.
Exactly. And it's, you know, oftentimes it goes back to what we were saying earlier, and James talks about, you know, the use of our tongue. We think we got everything straight and we're doing okay because we don't go out and rob people, we don't kill people, we don't do all these really bad things, but we're out hanging out with our friends and we're gossiping and slandering and, you know, those kind of things. And where are we? We're right in the world, right in the cesspool. Our religion, he says, is worthless. So we have to make sure that we don't allow ourselves to be pulled down and dragged in. And again, how is that going to be accomplished? What has to happen in order for that to be accomplished? We've got to not just know it, but we've got to do it. You see?
Well, I was going to say that as a young Christian, Brother Harper always drilled into me, make friends with Christians. You know, when I was first baptized. For a long time, I couldn't understand why this had to be, you know. But, you know, as I grew as a Christian, I could see it, because as a young Christian, if you stay where you were at, it's going to drag you right back into the mud and into the mire. And saying this, I think it puts a responsibility on us as older Christians when we get young Christians coming into it. Befriend them so that they have a different way of how to deal with the daily life as a Christian, versus go right back to your old friends. They're going to drag you right back to where you were before you became a Christian.
Well, and you're right, but it's not just the young people, even the older people.
Yeah.
You know, anybody. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, I put the this plug in, all right? Why the elders have been talking so much about looking out for each other better and doing it. Let's get in each other's homes. Let's fellowship more with one another. That we take folks that are young Christians, new Christians, whether they're old or young in age, but that we get them involved in our lives so they have different group of people to hang around with. You see? So that, you know, they have alternatives rather than just going back to the same old crowd they've been hanging around with. Where are they going to find themselves? And then we wonder what happened. So that's part of the reason for that, is that we've got to encourage one another, you know, in that kind of a way, and help each other to be able to keep ourselves from being unspotted or unstained by the world. All right? And again, you know, one of the things that Tommy says in his book on this, a statement that he makes, he says, knowing what God expects of us is not very, very difficult. The difficulty is in disciplining ourselves to do what we know. See? It's easy to know it, but it doesn't do us any good to know it and not do it. Because as we said earlier in our study, and he says, the blessings come not from the knowing, but from the doing. See? So, you know, we can know all we want to, but if we don't act on what we know, then it's not going to do us much good. Okay? Any other thoughts on that? On that part of our study at all? Ray?
I think that it's so important to have two disciplines and do the right thing. You can get caught up in things. It's like anybody that, let's say, someone who drinks, a problem with drinking. The only way you're going to get away from the drinking is to get away from the crowd and get angry. And we need to make sure that we stay within our boundaries. Because we know the God we serve is not one that appreciates food. He wants us to live our lives the way he's showing us in the book. Every Christian needs to read a chapter of some kind every day to help keep their mind focused on him. Because it's so easy to get away from him. It's easy to get away from it sometimes if we continue on in it. And
easier to be pulled off of the fence than it is to pull exactly someone else up onto it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it does. It takes daily discipline in our life.
Yes, it does.
All right, let's move on to the next section here. We're actually finished with chapter one. Okay? We move on to chapter two here. And James opens this particular part by talking about not showing favoritism. Okay, do not show favoritism. So we're going to be talking about being polluted by partiality. Right? Let's talk, before we get into the text of this, let's talk about just some the reality of partiality. Right. Is that a problem? Is it a problem in the church and so forth? And what are we doing and what can we do to make sure that it's not a problem? Okay. We had a song leader in a church that I previously worked for years ago. And I'll just tell you, it was the church, first church I ever worked for was up in Charlottesville. And this particular song leader, and he was one of our regular song leaders, he was a very highly educated man. I'll just leave it at that. And he had a tremendous amount of respect for educated people. And he was closely tied with the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And oftentimes what would happen is when he was up there, you know, welcoming people at the beginning of services, as he's getting ready to open us up with song and so forth, if there was someone, because he was really good about greeting people when they'd come in before, you know, service at all. He was really great about greeting folks and meeting them and all this. And if he met someone that was a highly educated person, especially if perhaps they were highly educated at the University of Virginia, and maybe they, you know, were coming there visiting, or maybe they had moved back in, you know, or visiting in the area or whatever, he would make it a point to make sure that everybody knew who they were and how glad we were to have them there. Brother so-and-so, who has a degree, a doctorate in such and such and such and such, and his lovely wife, or if it's the case of the woman, she's, you know, an amazing scholar in this, and he would go on and on about this person. And then oftentimes say, and we welcome the rest of our visitors too. How do you think that the rest of the visitors felt, you say, because they weren't the esteemed Dr. So-and-so that was visiting from wherever they were visiting and so forth? They're just common folk. And I used to, it was so bad that whenever he got up and started, I would just cringe. Thinking about other folks that, you know, were there visiting that I had met, and that were just, you know, family that was here visiting grandma, you know. When we show favoritism, we are creating problems. Now, I think that we do a really good job here, okay, of welcoming people and making everyone feel good about being here. Okay, I think as a church we do that. I have to apologize to folks all the time because I'm not as good with names as I used to be, and so I don't remember everybody's names. So I don't have to ask you over and over again, but. You know, I continue trying to work on that. But I think that we do a really good job here. I hear from visitors and folks that come in, new people that say, you know, this is a really friendly group of folks. Very warm and welcoming and so forth. I've never heard anybody say about us as a church, as a family, that they came here and they didn't feel like they were wanted or welcomed. I've never heard that from anyone. But I've heard lots and lots of the other things. But here's a question for us to consider. And this kind of goes back to, again, our focus that we're trying to do and looking out for one another and so forth, looking out for one another better. How about how we treat others outside of worship? In other words, once we've done all that, we welcome folks and we feel really good about being here, and you know, and isn't it great and warm and fuzzy and all that kind of stuff while we're here, we worship together and so forth. What happens once we leave? Do we forget about those folks? See? And do we concern ourselves with them? Do we make efforts to, you know, involve them in our lives, to invite them to something outside of our Sunday morning worship or things of that nature? Do we, outside of worship, pay more attention to the well-off than we do to the poor? Okay. And these are just questions for us to, you know, to think about and consider. All right? Are we influenced into worldly things by the rich, so to speak? I.e., we want them, we want to be with them rather than with someone who's not quite as well off kind of a situation. Okay? How do we handle those kinds of circumstances and those kind of folks? Again, once we leave here. What do we do in terms of interacting with folks under those kinds of circumstances? What we want to do to understand what James wants us to know about this, we need to look at another parable, so to speak, that James tells. We looked at one earlier. We call it a parable when he talks about the man who looks at his face in a mirror and then walks away and forgets what he says. Well, in a sense, here's another parable from James in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. He talks about two men who go into your worship assembly. Okay? And as he describes, you know, this situation, okay, James is admonishing the church to stop showing favoritism. Right? Why is that so important? Well, first of all, because it's completely incompatible with those who belong to Christ to show favoritism in any way, shape, or form. Since Jesus died for who? All men. Not just for the rich, not just for the poor, okay? He died for everyone. Not just, you know, for the white, not just for the black, not just for the educated, not just for the not-so-educated. He died for everyone. All men. And so, since Jesus died for everyone, his followers cannot and must not discriminate against anybody based on any of those criteria. Not race, not gender, not, you know, social standing or anything else. So James is telling us, he's going to share with us, in a sense, this parable, so to speak, that describes a typical worship assembly that is attended by two visitors. Okay? As he describes these two men, both men appear, they both are described or presented, in a sense, as visitors to a worship assembly of the church. Are they not? Okay, two men come into your assembly. I think the King James translation says into the synagogue. Does it? Isn't that what it says? That you have the King James?
The assembly.
Okay, in the assembly. In some of the translations uses the term synagogue, which basically is talking about and kind of indicates to us that James's audience at that particular time was most likely made up primarily of Jewish Christians. Okay? They would perhaps be assembling in a synagogue for their worship. All right? They would at least be familiar with that concept and so forth. But beyond that, that these two men come into the worship assembly, that's where the similarities end. Okay? That's it. They both come in as visitors to the assembly. One is described as wearing what? Gold ring and fine clothes. Okay? Obviously, a rich person, a rich man. The mention of wearing a gold ring, that in and of itself would indicate someone of means, because most folks back then, they didn't have the means to be able to purchase a gold ring. See? So common folks wouldn't likely have that. So the fact that this man had a gold ring would indicate that he was of some means. And then tack on to that, he also was wearing what?
Fine clothes.
Okay. So James is describing here a person who is well-to-do, well-off, or rich, as he's going to clarify later on in this in his statements concerning this. Okay, the articles that this person would be wearing are not articles that a common person would be wearing. Okay, any thoughts on how would we kind of parallel that with today, the terminology that we use and so forth today?
Designer clothes.
Okay, designer clothes. But even more specifically, when it comes to church, that's a phrase that we oftentimes our church clothes or our Sunday go to meeting clothes. See? We dress up all fine, you know, in our Sunday best. Okay. They didn't have Sunday best, not common folks. They wore what they had to wear. So there's a very clear distinction between these two men, all right, in terms of this first one being described as very wealthy. The other man is described as he is wearing what? He is a poor man in filthy clothes or shabby clothes. The Greek word there, rouperos, literally means dirty or filthy. Okay? So what a huge contrast between the rich man who is in fine clothes and this poor man who is in dirty, filthy clothes. If you look up in chapter 1, verse 21, okay, the same word is used there where James talks about moral filth and evil. Same word. Okay. So what's the impression that you get that James is wanting us to get of this man? These two men are complete opposites. Based solely on what?
Their appearance.
Based solely on their appearance. Right. But I mean it's this man appears to be wealthy, this man appears to be poor. Okay? In other words, the circumstance and the situation of the favoritism being shown is based at that point solely on what they look like. Okay? Now, guess what? We're out of time. What I want you to do is I want you to look at this passage, this parable, so to speak. We're going to pick up here next week, and let's talk about what James is telling us about this whole idea of showing favoritism. All right? And we'll continue with this. Thank you all very much.